There, the Wasatch Mountains tower behind the stadium. I mean, it's just perfect.
Who's got my back?
I got your back.
Who's got my back?
And tonight, the East High Leopards are up against the Roy High Royals. And the game is underway. The scene here is so typical. I mean, this happens pretty much every Friday night, every fall, in almost every community across the country.
Touchdown Leopards!
At the end of the game, the Leopards trounce the Royals, 65-14. It's a massacre, and frankly, it was uncomfortable to watch. And then something unexpected happens. The Leopards gather at center field, and the crowd comes down from the stadium to join them. One guy steps to the front, Tennessee Sue Sue, a senior offensive lineman. Tennessee shouts, and the team responds. He sticks out his tongue, bugs out his eyes. His teammates drum their chest and their thighs in unison. This is the haka, a traditional Polynesian war dance. I know, you're wondering, Polynesian war dance? Salt Lake City, what? See, Salt Lake has a big Polynesian population, and the reason is Mormonism, which is baked deep into the foundations of this place. Mormon missionaries started their work in the South Pacific in the 1800s, and they were so successful that the region now has some of the highest concentrations of Mormons outside of Utah. Lots of Polynesians feel a connection to Salt Lake as a spiritual homeland, so many settle here, which brings us back to football. Partly because they happen to be big people, young Samoan and Tongan players stack the roster of teams across Salt Lake. And over the past few years, football traditions have become more Polynesian too. Nephi Prime, a New Zealander of Maori origin, wrote a special haka just for the Leopards.
There are different proverbs in there. One of them is Matiatu Hetua, Haramaira Hetua. As one warrior dies, another warrior rises to take his place. I was talking about past members that have played in that team. They are Matiatu Hetua. They are the ones that have left, and now Tennessee and his boys, they are the ones Matiatu Hetua, Haramaira Hetua. They are the warriors that are here now, following the footsteps of those that have left that legacy for East High.
Tennessee says one of the coolest things about this haka is seeing white, black, and Latino students on his team embrace it as their own. But as the haka has spread to teams across Salt Lake, across Utah, in fact, it's been met with resistance in some places. One school considered banning the haka after it escalated into a fight with another team. A couple years ago, police in the small town of Roosevelt misinterpreted the haka as aggression and pepper sprayed the players. But Nephi says it's not about aggression. It's about tradition.
It's about pumping up the guys. For Polynesians, that's how we went into battle.
There's something about this story that gets at the heart of modern Salt Lake City for me. Maybe it's the way that Mormonism, which has shaped the city from its very beginnings, has had anything but a predictable influence on the place. The religion's global reach has created a community with, at times, surprising diversity. I think we tend to have one pretty undiverse view of Utah. You know, young missionaries in white shirts and thin black ties riding bicycles. But it's a lot more complicated than that, especially in Salt Lake City, a blue city in a deep red state, where the interplay of old traditions and new can be pretty fascinating. I'm going to bring in one of our producers, Ms. Delaney Hall, to help set up our next story, which is all about how the city's oldest and perhaps most entrenched institution is being shaken from the ground up. Hey, Delaney.
Hey, Al.
So, yeah, I think it's safe to say that the world was pretty much stunned when a judge in Utah overturned the state's ban on gay marriage in December 2013.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you could hear how amazed journalists were as they covered the event.
Unbelievable scene here as one couple after the other gets married. Just
in Utah, one of the hearts of conservative religion in America.
Today, a federal judge in Utah. Yes, that Utah.
struck down the state's ban on same-sex marriage. This was the very
And the big reason that people were shocked, obviously, is that Utah is Mormon country. The church is politically powerful, and it's also pretty staunchly anti-gay marriage.
Right. I mean, I know the church is big on traditional marriage, but it has been evolving when it comes to other issues affecting the LGBT community, right?
Yeah, I think that's true. Church doctrine about homosexuality hasn't changed much, but there's a growing group of people at the grassroots level of the church who definitely have. And that really started with the last big gay marriage upheaval in Utah, which was the passage of California Proposition 8 back in 2008.
Wait, Proposition 8 banned gay marriage in California, so what does that have to do with Utah?
Well, yeah, it's kind of complicated. The Mormon Church actually played a big role in getting Prop 8 passed. Here, let me back up a step and introduce you to Troy Williams.
Bradley Bruff. All right, Adam White and Bradley Bruff, welcome to Radioactive. We've just heard a clip from your recently produced...
Troy is a radio host at KRCL in Salt Lake City. Growing up, he was a devout Mormon, pretty much as devout as they get. But he had a secret.
I did have this thing rumbling inside of me, this attraction to men. And I listened to all the LDS rhetoric that somehow this was because I didn't properly bond with my father or I didn't internalize my masculinity in some way. And so I prayed and prayed and prayed that God would take this thing from me if I was super righteous.
So Troy became super righteous. He went to Brigham Young University and volunteered for the Utah Eagle Forum, which is one of the most conservative organizations in the state. Eventually, he came out and began the long, painful process of leaving the church. Now he's known as the gay mayor of Salt Lake, and he's a careful observer of how the church operates politically.
The LDS Church is, they're very much a minority in these different states, but they really learned how to be politically effective back in the 70s with the Equal Rights Amendment. They recognized that by mobilizing their very small numbers, they could actually turn the results of elections, and they were very successful at making sure that certain key states did not ratify the ERA.
The church started flexing those political muscles again when California's Proposition 8 came up for a vote.
What ended up happening was that there was a coalition formed called NOM, the National Organization for Marriage.
Brandy Balkin is the executive director of Equality Utah, an LGBT rights organization in Salt Lake.
One of the lead players in NOM was the LDS Church, and there was actually a call from the pulpit for people to give of their time or of their financial resources. Not only was an immense amount of money generated to support the campaign, but an immense amount of volunteers moved into California to do knock and walks in communities, and it turned the tides.
On the night of November 4th, 2008, the same night that Barack Obama was elected president, California passed Prop 8.
For LGBT Americans, it was such a stunning blow across the country. We had elected the first African-American president. And that the same day, Californians voted against the rights of LGBT Californians. And that hurt. And then for us in Utah to recognize that so much of the funding, so much of the organizing actually came from downtown Salt Lake City. And we were furious.
Several thousand carrying signs and banners marched around Temple Square insisting they reject the vote on Prop 8.
Beyond the fact that we are gay, first and foremost, we are American citizens.
Concerned that emotions were...
There was sort of this posting up of these two communities, LDS and LGBT, of the LDS Church saying, this is our core value set and we will not back down. And the LGBT community saying, one, this isn't your home state, and two, don't you realize that you're pushing people to oppress people just like me? And I'm your daughter. I'm your neighbor. I go to work with you.
Protests continued for weeks, for months. There were kiss-ins outside the Salt Lake Temple, the spiritual and political center of the church.
And it was at that point that we got a response call. That's what I'll say. We got a response call. And I was very, I welcomed it.
You know, the church reached out to us and said, okay, we are getting hammered in the press. We're getting hammered everywhere. Let's start to have conversations.
Mike Otterson, a spokesman for the LDS Church, tells it a little bit differently. He says the church was not surprised by the response to Prop 8. They stand by their involvement in that issue. Instead, he says that they reached out to prominent gay activists because of what they were hearing from their own members.
I was in meetings where some of the apostles would share letters that they had received from parents. And those parents were often letters that were pleading. They would say, I need to know how to deal with this. I'm going to lose, you know, my son or my daughter. There were some that were written by members who had those feelings of attraction to the same sex and were struggling with how to deal with it. And it became obvious that there was some real feelings, some real concerns that were not being addressed very effectively.
I mean, they called the meeting. We went up to this private home and sat down for about 2 hours and just sort of started to talk about where we were at and what we saw in our communities, and did a little bit of that, like, who are you, where are you from, tell me your story, tell me about your family.
I mean, it's really easy to boycott, and it's really easy to get in a rally with all your friends and actually get people riled up. But what is most difficult is actually sitting down with someone who you perceive to be your enemy and actually putting your life out there for them and actually opening up your heart to them. And that's what the LGBT community knew that we had to do with the LDS Church.
And it kind of worked. When Equality Utah, Brandy's organization, started working for non-discrimination policies in Salt Lake City a few months later, ordinances that would ban firing or evicting people based on their sexual orientation.
And we got a call from them saying, we're going to endorse this ordinance. We had never discussed it in our meetings. We had never lobbied or petitioned them to support it.
And those non-discrimination ordinances, it turns out, were just the beginning. There was a whole movement developing in the lower levels of the church among ordinary members that we'll explore next when So True continues.
If you're already an annual supporter of WILL, why not shift your gift to our sustainer option? Shifting your valued support to continuous monthly giving has a powerful impact on our station. When we know we can count on your support each month, we become a stronger community resource. It's an affordable, convenient way to support the programs you love. So, still have questions? Call us 1-800-898-1065 or go to willpledge.org.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the Subaru Impreza, with standard all-wheel drive and an EPA highway rating of 36 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at SubaruofChampaign.com or at their location on Route 45 in Savoy.
I'm Al Letson, and this is State of the Reunion. Today we're in Salt Lake City, exploring how Mormon activists are trying to make the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints a more welcoming place for LGBT members. Delaney Hall, one of our producers, is telling the story.
Get in line and come get some food.
About a dozen people are here at Erica Munson's house for dinner. They fill their plates, then sit in a big circle in the living room. The gathering is a lot like what you'd find at after church Sunday dinners across Salt Lake City, but with one big difference. These folks have come together to talk about one of the most vexing issues the church currently faces: lesbian, gay, and transgender Mormons.
Learning more about the LGBT experience might be at first a hard thing for straight people to understand, and so that's kind of why we're here tonight.
A lot of Erica's activist work has to do with trying to get gay and straight Mormons talking with each other.
It's easy, I think, in this country right now for things to get very polarized and to have a lot of us in them. But if you sit down and eat dinner with somebody, it can be a whole different thing.
And it's pretty clear that tonight is a whole different thing. After a tall blonde guy named John, just back from his Mormon mission, talks about trying to be more open and accepting, a lesbian mom who left the church years ago does some matchmaking.
So I came to get more empathy and to have a better, more perfect love.
I have a beautiful 21-year-old daughter. Just in case you wanted something to, you know.
Yeah. Erica is the mother of five and a lifelong churchgoer.
TBM, True Blue Mormon.
which makes her an unlikely spokeswoman for an issue that has cut deep divides in the Mormon community. Erica never felt totally comfortable with the church's stance on homosexuality, but she started to feel really troubled by the issue back in 2008. That's when Mormon leadership supported Proposition 8 in California, which banned gay marriage in the state. For a few years, she watched as LGBT people left the church, feeling unwelcome. And her uneasiness grew.
So by the time we got to 2012, Mormons were figuring out, well, how can I show my love and support for gay people after this debacle? What can I do?
Erica decided to organize a Mormon group to march in Salt Lake's annual Gay Pride Parade. They wore their Sunday best and carried signs that said, LDS loves LGBT and sorry we're late. It was the first time a group of Mormons participated in a serious way. Erica thought maybe 25 people would show up to march. Over 300 did.
It was an amazing experience because the parade starts, we go down this small block where everyone's lining up, and then we turn the corner and there were hundreds and hundreds of people cheering and clapping for us. And here, we were trying to show unconditional love and acceptance, but we were actually being taught about unconditional love and acceptance and forgiveness by the people on the parade route, many of whom had been hurt by the church.
Building on the momentum of the parade, Erica started an organization called Mormons Building Bridges, and they began working on other projects aimed at closing the divide between the LDS and LGBT communities. They work within existing church doctrine, so they don't take a political stance on issues like gay marriage, but they do emphasize compassion. One of the first issues they tackled, LGBT youth homelessness, a big problem in Utah.
Thank you.
It's taco night at the Outreach Resource Center, a gathering place for LGBT youth in the Salt Lake Valley. A couple dozen young people are hanging out here in the basement of a local Unitarian church. The center serves youth from all over Salt Lake Valley. It's a safe place where they can get a warm meal or pick up a sleeping bag and some cans of food if they're living on the street, which a dismaying number of gay teens are.
Too many times I've had a youth show up at Outreach with a suitcase or a stuffed backpack and say, Marion, what do I do?
This is Marion Edmonds Allen. Until just recently, she was the executive director of the center.
My parents told me I have to get out. I don't know where to go. What do I do now? I heard a youth say today that her mom said that she wished that she had had an abortion rather than have a gay child. This is what happens here every day.
Gay youth are overrepresented in the homeless population across the country, and here in Utah, it's no different. Although this practice is changing, we heard stories about Mormon leaders advising families to kick out their gay kids to help them straighten up. Until recently, Marion couldn't do much if a teen showed up with nowhere else to go.
I say, okay, do you have a friend with a couch? That's your best option. I load them up with supplies and hygiene items that they need, and I send them off. Sometimes the youth come back. Mostly the Mormon youth, I never see them again. They just disappear.
Marion thought this was crazy. She needed better options for these kids. So she got in touch with Mormons Building Bridges, and together they've created a program called Safe and Sound. The goal is to build a network of host homes, just ordinary families, willing to take in an LGBT kid with nowhere else to go. The program is still small. Nika Alga, David Moore, and their three sons are the first host family. Nika has been a Mormon for her whole life, but she only became involved in LGBT issues when it became personal.
I was not aware of the problem of LGBT youth homelessness until my own child came out as transgender.
Nika and David started meeting other Mormon families with gay kids and learning about their struggles to navigate those two identities. They've supported their son Grayson through his transition from female to male, and he's even stayed connected to the church. They wanted to help other LGBT kids whose parents might not be as accepting.
Oh, you want to see some of my pictures?
Yeah.
Okay.
The family has recently taken in their first teen. Ashley, who's 18 years old, has been staying with them for the past 2 weeks.
These are my drawings. I'm kind of like into drawing flowers and abstract art. Like that started with a teardrop, turned into an ant holding a mushroom and a flower with the sun and the moon.
She's showing me around her new bedroom at Nika and David's house. When she left home, she packed a small suitcase with just a few changes of clothes and some of her art supplies.
And then there's another gay rights one. Rainbow, born gay, follow the ray, born straight, refuse to hate.
Being gay in small town Idaho, where Ashley grew up, was not easy. She got her first crush on a girl in 7th grade.
I finally told my mom, because I was tired of her trying to get me to go out with guys. And when I came out, I felt like I had a big, huge burden lifted off my chest.
But it caused problems, too. She and her mom started getting in fights.
Finally, my mom just had enough of me, and she booted me out.
Ashley had spent time in a homeless shelter before, but was bullied for being gay. So she told a new friend on Facebook that she didn't have anywhere to go. That friend lived in Utah and told her mom about Ashley's situation. The friend's mom called Safe and Sound.
And that's how we were able to connect up.
Here's Nika again.
In a way, it's like, woohoo, our referral network worked. And in a way, it's like, oh my gosh, how close we came to not having made that connection.
Nika and David jumped in their car and drove 3 hours north to get Ashley, who was a bit freaked out to be picked up by two people she'd never met before.
Because you gotta think, getting into a car with two strange adults, you don't really know if your life is in danger or not. But I just threw my hands in the air and trusted that I'd be safe.
Since then, she's been settling into life in Utah. She wants to be a chef, and she signed up with a job training program. She's also getting to know her host family. Tonight, they're making Mexican food together.
What would you want to, you know, if you could get your dream job in some particular restaurant, what do you think it would be?
The gourmet. That's where I'm going.
You know, having somebody placed in my home is kind of like having had a new baby without, you know, the diapers and the spit. But we're having to create this relationship and get to know what she needs and what she wants.
While Nika works on getting Ashley comfortable in her new home, Nika's husband David works on expanding Safe and Sound. They've been spreading the word about the program to churches, schools, and social service agencies throughout the Salt Lake Valley. And they've been recruiting new host families, too, who have to undergo an intense screening process to become part of the program.
Welcome, everyone, to what I think will be the first annual...
Tonight is the first ever Safe and Sound meeting. Volunteers split into different groups depending on their interests, and they've got lots of questions.
If there's actually mental challenges they have, if they're scarred in some way, we're willing to do everything. We can support somebody.
Counselor group is for? Like, yes. Do we team up with them and then there's...
Building a new program from scratch is tough, and David and Nika know there will be confusion and uncertainty along the way. But with a shelter system that's intimidating for young people to navigate, and as many as 2,000 gay teens living on the streets of Utah each year, Safe and Sound is working as fast as they can to help homeless teens like Ashley.
If my girlfriend's mother wouldn't have heard of Safe and Sound, and I wouldn't have had help from Nika and David, I would probably still be living on the streets right now. Because I had nobody. I would have been alone.
Since we visited Salt Lake City, the Safe and Sound program has expanded. There are now 4 host families ready to accept youth, and the volunteer network has grown to 125. After spending about a month and a half with Nika and David, Ashley reunited with her extended family in Idaho. The Shoshone are a Native American people scattered across Oregon, Nevada, Wyoming, Idaho, and Utah. Like many tribes, they're fighting to keep their language alive, especially among kids, very few of whom speak it. The Shoshone are looking to change that by applying modern technology to their ancient language.
Okay, so I got the game up.
That's Devin Gardner, a Shoshone College student. Last summer, he helped build and design Anna, the first ever Shoshone language video game. He navigates his avatar across a computer screen, a wispy figure like a character from a Tim Burton movie with a feather in his hair.
So basically, the plot of the game is your life starts normally in your little house, and you explore and you go outside.
So the welcome beach, Nadayana.
And then a tragic event happens, like the cannibal birds attacking, and you get taken far away from your village.
Yeah.
So that basically the entire point of the game is to get back to your home.
This journey requires players to use Shoshone vocabulary to solve puzzles, and it immerses kids in a whole Shoshone worldview, drawing on traditional stories and culture. For instance, your guide is a coyote, a trickster you can't really rely on.
You was a condom awake.
He gives you good advice that sounds like really bad advice.
And you come across scary creatures from Shoshone stories along the way. Here's Cora Burchett, another team who created the artwork for the game.
We have water babies. They are little creatures that dwell around swampy areas or around water. And they can shapeshift.
And we've got the Zoa Bitch, which is a rock monster that will snatch up crying children at night.
You have to talk to a bunch of different characters.
Like a grandmother figure who asks you to fetch sticks, antlers, and a woven basket.
It's your hoopie. It's your arm. It's your animals.
It's a lot of problem solving. And the hints that you're given are only in Shoshone. So you have to put it together.
The video game was created by a team of young people, including Devin and Cora, who work with two departments at the University of Utah, the Entertainment Arts and Engineering Program, and the Shoshone Language Project, a group dedicated to keeping language alive. A simple idea guides their work. If young people don't speak Shoshone, it won't survive. But if they ever are going to be inspired to learn the language...
Their language has to be cool. The way they talk has to be cool.
This is Mariana DiPaolo, the director of the Shoshone Language Project. She gets the strong link between teen speakers' coolness and keeping the language alive. So a few years back, she developed a summer program specifically for young people. She invited teens like Devin and Cora to come stay at the university over the summer.
And they bond with the language. They're together 24/7. They go to class, they work, they do this, they do that. It's like Shoshone boot camp.
The boot camp has resulted in Shoshone language children's books and a talking dictionary based on recordings of elders. But for a generation of teens raised online, the program had to figure out a creative way of merging technology and language. And so the idea for the video game was born, a scary adventure quest that would blend an ancient language with a new form. Devin and Cora both come from Shoshone backgrounds. They had very different experiences growing up. Cora was raised on the Duckwater Shoshone Reservation in Nevada. Her grandmother spoke the language, and she remembers hearing many of these traditional stories while growing up.
I remember one time specifically, I was standing in the bathroom trying to brush my teeth, and I can't remember what I was upset about, but I started crying, and my grandma said, "Don't cry at night. The Zoa Bitch is going to come get you."
Devin, on the other hand, knew almost nothing about his Shoshone roots. His great-grandmother hid her identity from the world, wearing makeup to lighten her skin.
Back then, Native children were really picked on and stuff in school for being Native, and I think in order for her to avoid all that trouble in school, she just denied the fact that she was Native.
Director Mariana DiPaolo says this was a big reason the language began to die off. Throughout the late 1800s and into the 1900s, many of the Native kids were forced to attend boarding schools specifically meant to strip them of their language and culture.
The mantra, "kill the Indian, save the man," meant essentially the only way that we can get rid of the Indian problem, because it was viewed as a problem, is to acculturate Indians into white culture. Young children were pulled out of their family homes, away from their parents, out of their mother's arms sometimes, and taken away to boarding schools where they were only allowed to use English, any word in any other language was severely punished.
And over the decades, the consequences of losing a language only magnified the bigger traumas of cultural assault.
Loss of language leads to loss of self-esteem, which is very closely tied to things like suicide, alcoholism, and other very, very serious psychological disorders. People who come to know their native language, even a little part of it, can sometimes turn that around.
Which makes the intention of this video game, in fact, very real.
The purpose is you can get into that game, and it's a different world, and that world is powered by the Shoshone language and the Shoshone culture.
Which is empowering.
Which is empowering.
You know, because suddenly your little language that, you know, has been shooed away by the masses or whatever is the center of this universe.
Yep.
You know, you got to feel good when you're a kid playing that.
It's empowering, not just because these young people can play it, because they got to create it.
I'm hoping that with Anna, people will be able to see that technology in a dying language isn't a bad thing, so they can actually start incorporating their language and culture into games similar to Anna, and then help revitalize other languages as well.
And that would be the hope, to see that the language is a language of their ancestors, but the language could also be a language of their future.
Up next, a youth media program reinvents juvenile justice by giving kids in detention a chance to send their stories to the outside world. That's when State of the Reunion continues. Support for State of the Reunion comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, a growing network of listeners, producers, and stations collaborating to make public radio more public. PRX.org.
A new box set collects 16 films that director Werner Herzog made between 1970 and 1999, including Fitzcarraldo, A Gare, The Wrath of God, and Nosferatu the Vampire. On the next Fresh Air, we feature an interview with Herzog, and John Powers reviews the box set. Join us.
Weekday mornings at 11 and again at 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support comes from the Urbana Business Association, presenting the 39th Annual Urbana Sweet Corn Festival this Friday, August 22nd and Saturday, August 23rd in downtown Urbana. There will be entertainment, activities, and, of course, sweet corn. More information is at urbanabusiness.com.
I'm Al Letson, and this is State of the Reunion. Today, we are in Salt Lake City, a place defined by its outsiders as well as its insiders. Now, on the inside, of course, you've got the Mormon population, deeply tied to the traditional roots of the place. And on the outside, you've got, well, pretty much everyone else. Both groups orbit around this same space, and both have developed some pretty unique ways of holding their communities together. We'll explore this in our next two stories, beginning with a group of young people who fall about as far on the outside of mainstream as you can get. Adam Sherlock, a bearded guy with gauges in his ears, is headed into work. He's dragging a huge box filled with audio recording equipment. He goes through one locked door. And another locked door. And one last locked door. This is the Decker Lake Youth Correctional Center. Young people end up here for drug and alcohol issues and gang-related crimes. Many have committed violent offenses, and many have repeatedly failed out of the system.
Hi, guys. What's going on?
Before we break everything out,
Adam worked in corrections for a while, but he's now an instructor at a local youth media organization called SpyHop. Once a week, since 2009, he comes to Decker Lake and teaches young offenders how to make audio stories about their lives on a podcast called Sending Messages. It's the only podcast in the country that's hosted and produced by incarcerated youth, and it features essays, interviews, poems, and music, all based around a certain theme.
Like This American Life, but like in kid jail.
Welcome to Sending Messages.
Welcome to Sending Messages.
Welcome to Sending Messages.
True stories, poetry, music, and interviews written, recorded,
this is a Spy High production. The world is full of cages. Places made to hold someone or something. Sometimes these cages are easy to recognize, but oftentimes...
Each of us at the corrections facility plan, hope, and dream of one day.
For this 4th of July episode, we thought it would be fitting to explore the idea of freedom.
The idea behind Sending Messages is to teach kids how to write, how to make art, and, in the process, how to think about their lives in new ways.
Because I think when kids go into lockup, they're at their most vulnerable. They're in this catalytic moment where they're really deciding, like, which direction am I going to go? Am I going to follow in the footsteps of other family members and just be like, well, it's too late for me. I'm just going to end up going to prison like those guys did. Or are they really going to change? And to be able to walk into a room in that moment, and it's this lightning in the bottle moment, and say, let's make some art. Let's tell some stories. And once they start telling those stories, you can start dissecting these experiences that they've had.
Adam has about 5 young men in the class with him today, all dressed in beige khakis and green polos that they're required to wear. Adam starts off, as he usually does, with a short reading picked by one of the kids.
Right. Not to laugh, not to lament, not to judge, but to understand.
That's cool, man. I like that. How does that speak to you? What does that mean?
Because it's like, you rather have people understand you rather than to judge you, to laugh at you. I don't know what lament means, but...
Well, let me ask you this. So do you think that, because it seems like that's, we do that, right? Like everybody...
The Sending Messages podcast gets around 700 downloads a month. Over 100 young people have contributed work in the 5 years the program has been running. Stories give listeners a glimpse into the minds of detained youth, helping them better understand the regrets they have and the struggles they faced. And it's not just friends and family who listen. People within the juvenile justice system do too, like Youth Parole Board member Jennifer Yim.
You learn about people. You don't just learn about kids who get incarcerated. You learn about yourself, and you learn about the human condition, and you learn about how hard it is. And I think that that has made me maybe better attuned to what's involved in really working on yourself and thinking about what your freedom's worth.
You know, I had a student several years ago, really smart kid and incredible poet, and he relayed to me a story of one of his earliest memories being going with his mom and his dad and them breaking a window and cleaning all the glass out and pushing him through at 2 years old so he could go through the apartment and unlock it so they could go in and rob the place. He was a third generation gangbanger.
They come from shitty backgrounds.
Mark Marsing has been teaching at the public school inside Decker Lake for 20 years. He says Sending Messages gives kids here something they can't get in other classes at the school.
In the English and science and math classroom, they're supposed to behave this way. And in that class, they get to express themselves in their way, whether it's the music they like, the street life that they had good and bad memories from, how they miss their moms and dads, and even though mom and dad might be in prison.
My mom left me when I was 2, and so I lived with my dad, but me and him never got along. So when I hit about 13, 14, I ran away.
Troy is 18 now, which means he spent about 5 years on and off the streets before ending up at Decker Lake.
I stayed parks, under trailers. Once you're on the, like, streets for over a year, you kind of get the hang of things.
Girl that brought light to my gloomy days. Okay, I like it so far. First sentence, throw a comma after Sarah. Now you got a good pause there, Sarah.
Today, Adam is working with Troy on a story he wrote about a girl he met when they were both living as runaways. Adam is prodding the piece into shape, pushing Troy to choose his words carefully.
If she's your last love, you can think of something better to say about her than being a redheaded white girl. Right?
Yeah, they're not appropriate.
Okay, we'll find some that are. Come All on, right. You're a writer. You're All a writer. Right. What's a better way of describing her? You're in love with her. Be kind. I think that one of the ways in which these kids talk about their experiences culturally is either not by talking about it at all, or they war story it, right? So you're boasting or there's nothing. And if they come back with some Thug Life Tupac stuff, right, I always go, whoa, 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 whoa. You have to go sleep in a little cinder block room the size of a closet. So to be able to say to them, like, take your situation right now, and I want you to tell me the truth. As long as you tell the truth, I'm never going to tell you that you can't do it.
Trapped. I feel trapped in this hole I've dug myself. Sitting in a place where there's no way out.
Troy wrote this story for a recent podcast exploring the theme of cages. He recorded it in the timeout room at Decker Lake, a small cinder block space that doubles as a recording studio when the sending messages class is in session.
You know, and they'll put a little piece of paper up inside the window of the timeout room that says, quiet, recording in progress, you know. And that's probably the best thing that I've ever done in terms of, like, karmically trying to set my own balance, is after all the years I worked in corrections, I now have transformed three different timeout rooms at three different facilities into recording studios.
That doesn't fear anything. I can't do anything but sit and wallow in my own heartache and despair. In this hole, no one seems to care how you are doing.
Even if Adam manages to get the guys he works with to tell the truth while they're in the program, there's a tough question of what happens once they leave. He sees them change as they work on stories for sending messages, but do those changes stick?
I have a lot of criminal thinking, so I think of how I can steal something or how I can get over on something. But in this class, it helps me think, like, my decisions, who do they affect?
But you don't think that you're going to be able to use those lessons outside?
It depends.
Look, I'm not crazy. Like, I recognize, like, how hard it is when you get out of here to, like, stay away from the things that got you here in the first place. But still, like, part of the goal of these type of things is to try and help you think outside the box.
Yeah.
You know, do you think it's doing that with you? Do you think it's kind of opening you up?
While I'm in here, yes. But when I'm out there, say things don't go as planned and I go on the run, I'm going to turn back to the same people that I know are going to be there.
And for Troy, that's the guys in his old gang, the people he met on the streets.
I know of more situations that ended up becoming fatal for students than I have in college, you know, because that's the demographic. But at the same time, I think what the students learn about themselves is that they have more control over their situations than they might think that they do, and that they have worth. I remember in the very beginning when I very first brought, you know, the media cart, all of the MacBooks and all of the Tascams and microphones and mixers and dragged it in there. And, you know, one of my students, a kid named K.O., goes, you rich? I'm like, no. He's like, where did you get all this stuff? And I was like, well, so individuals donate money every year to the program, and those donors, they care about hearing what you guys have to say. And he kind of looked at me and he kind of frowned and he said, do they know who we are? And I said, yeah, they do. And he was like, whoa, that's really cool. And I think that for some of them, that is maybe the first time that's ever happened.
Dear whoever cares, sometimes I feel trapped. I'll be watching this body I'm trapped in do things like drugs and crimes. But it's not me. I'm just a puppet on strings, helpless, watching with horror the things this person is doing. They continually break the law, getting trapped in real prison for juveniles.
To find out how to subscribe to the Sending Messages podcast, visit our website, stateoftheReunion.com. So as we just heard, Salt Lake is a big city with big city problems. Even still, it has a distinctive Happy Valley sheen. From the outside, it often looks like the land of wholesome people and wholesome values. And one of the ways that expresses itself is food. Which brings us to a riddle. What do Salt Lake City and Bill Cosby have in common?
There's blackberry fusion and strawberry banana and lime and lemon and peach and orange, grape, apricot.
Things they get in your mouth. There's
yep, Jell-O. Pudding pop! Okay, so we're talking about Jell-O, but I can't say Bill Cosby Jell-O and not say Puddin' Pop! I digress. The link between Utah and Jell-O is now almost cliche. According to Kraft, the state regularly consumes more of the stuff than any other state in the nation. A bowl of green Jell-O appeared on hotly traded pins at the Winter Olympics in 2002. People even call Utah and the regions around it the Jell-O Belt. Weirdest of all, the legislature actually voted Jell-O to be the state's official snack food, which I wasn't even aware that that was a thing.
It's funny because it is National Jell-O Week, and in Utah, that takes on special significance.
Yeah. It's a very big deal.
It's the official snack.
You have
by government order.
You have some facts over there which I think are very interesting.
When the resolution urging Jell-O recognition passed in 2001, Bill Cosby himself testified saying, "I am proud, not because you're the number one consuming gelatin, but because you're the number one family state." Okay, so it's clear that it's a joke. A joke that Utah is in on, right? But there's also something kind of interesting going on. I mean, how did this connection come to be?
Hey, so we're just going to boil the water.
It's Sunday night at the Salazar family house, and Robin Salazar is making the official state snack. Although she thinks the whole official state snack thing is ridiculous.
Not my main snack.
But she does get why the connection exists. Making food, especially for big groups, is an essential part of Mormon culture.
Pretty much any church gathering that's not a worship service, anything else usually has food. We usually have ham and casseroles and cakes mainly for dessert.
And because it's cheap and easy to make in big batches, Jell-O always makes an appearance at church potlucks. It's also versatile enough that it's become something of an art form. People suspend fruit, vegetables, pretzels, and Cool Whip in their gelatin creations. These infinitely remixable combinations inspired Robin's uncle-in-law to create a kind of Jell-O Rosetta Stone.
The Jell-O Matrix is all the flavors of the Jell-O, like lemon, lime, strawberry, raspberry, and orange. Those go along the top. On the sides is what you can add to it, carrots and celery.
Roger Salazar calls Mormon food a hug from the inside.
Especially what I noticed about my partner, Michael Whiteman, is that food was the only treat they had. They didn't have vices. They didn't smoke or drink or do any of that. So it's the recreation for Mormons, food.
Roger and Michael's parody cookbook called No Man Knows My Pastries caught the eye of Christy Spackman. She grew up in Utah and now studies food and culture at New York University. She's written about the history and meaning of the Mormon Jell-O connection. It carries positive values, she says, like family-centeredness, thriftiness, but it carries negative ones too.
It's a really interesting question if you have a group of people who are characterized as eating a food that is really a food for children, is that then used as a way to make those people into something that are other, to put them down, or to say, you know, we're better than those people, we don't eat that way?
What people eat and the way we characterize what people eat goes deep. But even if she's critical of the way that Jell-O and Mormonism have become connected in our imaginations, Christy also has very good memories of the food too. Like from a Thanksgiving one year, when a woman made a 20-layer Jell-O salad, which took literally days of work.
When people take the time to prepare food for other people, it builds amazing bridges.
You know, that 20-layer Jell-O salad is just one small example of something we heard again and again in Salt Lake City. Mormons take time to take care of each other. They've got each other's backs.
Somebody's in financial need. We have this welfare program and provide food for them, and we have housing specialists and employment specialists. It goes on and on, and it can be a wonderful way to live in a Christian community because you're just taking care of each other.
Talk about a big warm hug, right? Everybody's all in it together at everything that you do, which touches everything in your life. And it creates a really interesting environment for people who are not in the embrace of the hug.
That is the flip side of the amazing community that the Mormon Church has cultivated. What happens when you're not a part of that hug? We heard a lot of those stories on our trip, too.
If you are aberrant, if you're gay, what was once a warm and loving place
becomes a dangerous, hostile place.
Our family is shunned in the neighborhood that we live in. No one will talk to us, and we don't hold hands. We've learned that that's not a safe thing to do.
One of the things, unfortunately, that Mormons didn't include was who I was as a human. I always say I didn't leave the church, they left me.
And so for me, the question in Salt Lake becomes how to make that hug a little bigger, how to harness the best spirit of the church, its organization and volunteerism, and expand it. It's clear that there are people that are already thinking about these things, but it'll take time to knock down these walls and reuse the rubble to build bridges. But in the meantime, those on the outside of that warm hug are learning to embrace each other.
When you have an environment that has such a strong overarching story, such a strong and organized overarching population, and you are not a part of that population, you start seeing people make connections and alliances and friendships that are far outside of what you would see in other cities, because there aren't that many of us. And you know who we've got is each other.
Updating Tradition was produced by Delaney Hall with help from senior editor Taki Telenitis. The rest of the So True staff is producer Tina Antolini and Laura Starcheski. Our business manager is Bree Burge. Our intern crew is Allie Bergerman, Eric Jones, and Kathy Tu. You can see photos from Salt Lake City and listen to our other episodes at stateoftherunion.com. So True is presented by WJCT and distributed by PRX and NPR, with major funding provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Al Edson.